The Recovery Broadcast Network is pleased to present the top 10 personal stories of recovery. Listen, as people in Narcotics Anonymous share their experience, strength, and hope with others so that they too can recover from the disease of addiction. If you cannot make a meeting, then check us out. We have what you are looking for right here. Remember that meeting makers make it. However, please be advised that these meetings are not intended to be a substitute for attending regular 12-step meetings. They are not a substitute for the fellowship and support found in a 12-step program. Finally, the Recovery Broadcast Network is not associated with Narcotics Anonymous or any other program of recovery in any way. So please sit back and get ready for a powerful story of recovery. Thank you and enjoy.
My name's Greg. I'm an addict. Hey, gang. Wow, Missouri. I can almost reach the back of the podium here. I just know I'm going to step off it. I believe in service. I know we joked around a little bit in the traditions with the slaves and stuff like that. A big part of my recovery has been involvement in service. And I don't know if it works or not, but, you know, I've been clean 23 years, and so far, so good. You know, it's one of the ways I fulfill my 9th, 11th, and 12th steps. And I personally don't believe that I can work those steps in any depth without being of service in some form. And I consider service to be a form of worship. It's not about your liking me or anything like that. It's about my devotion to that which I've bet my life on and my God. So service is real important to me. Anyway, let me tell you about the last week or two. Yeah, it's true. The last week or two, I've experienced a lot of little frustrations and things like that. I moved again about three weekends ago, I was moving. And I have this reputation for moving all the time, and I'd lug a lot of shit around with me when I used, because I have boxes full of papers that I've obsessively collected of NA stuff, and I have a mineral collection, and I move thousands of pounds of rocks, and I have, you know, paperback books and thousands of those, and I move all that stuff, and I carried all that stuff a couple of weeks ago again, and got in touch with some of the insanity one more time, some of the addict in me one more time, because I had to make some decisions about what I was going to leave and what I was going to keep, and, you know, I just hated to get rid of those rusty nails and some of those things that I've been saving for years, moving with me when I move, and, you know, it pointed out to me a little bit about the nature of my addiction. I believe in this disease concept we talk about, a threefold disease, that I have a physical, mental, and spiritual disease. The physical aspect, first and foremost, is somehow, some way, when I put drugs in my body, something happens that isn't normal, that I can't control. I have no ability to prevent that response. The mental aspect of that is the fact that I'll get strung out on anything. You know, I'll take wonderful things and make them self-destructive. And I'll talk some about that a little later, because I do that bad. And the third thing is that I suffer from this lack of faith, lack of hope, lack of trust, inability to relate to others as equals, obsession with self that we all seem to suffer from, self-obsession. And those are part of my persona. They're part of who Greg is. And I can't do anything about them. I can't do anything about the fact that I'm walking up to somebody and they say, "Hi, Greg," and my head goes, "They don't like me." I can't do anything about being instantly attracted to a woman who will only confirm my low self-esteem. I can't do anything about sitting up late at night, needing to go to bed because I got to wake up at 5 in the morning and finding some excuse to stay up a little bit later just because I might miss something. I can't do anything about those urges. I can do something about the behaviors that follow them. Anyway, one of the things that happened these last couple of weeks, besides getting in touch with the addict in me and some of those things, and my perfectionism, and, you know, moving the 2,000, 3,000 paperbacks wasn't bad enough, but it took a long time to alphabetize them. You know, and that's part of the nature of my disease. Last Monday, on the way home from work, I stopped and I got gas, and as I was leaving the gas station, and it was a half a block or so down to where the interstate is that I get on to go home, my transmission died. And at that point in time, I had five cars broke down. All five cars broke down. and I was not pleased with my higher power. In fact, I was downright pissed, and this is what one of those, you know, come on, God, can't you take a joke times, you know, and I was nuts. And I parked it and got a ride home, and, you know, by Tuesday, I was really crazy behind it. I was talking about, you know, all this sort of shitty day, you know, life sucks, you know, and I'd forgotten this thing, you know. We all come from the life suck school of philosophy, right? You know, and what I've learned in recovery is life doesn't suck. It doesn't have the capacity to suck. It's, you know, today is not a shitty day. It's just today. It's my attitude. And, you know, I love that little line in our readings that sometimes, I didn't hear it tonight, but sometimes at conventions they make fun of it. And then when it goes, there's one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. And someone says, drugs, you know. And, but what it really says is attitude. And long before the attitude, long before the drugs, there's usually the attitude. And I'm a firm believer in that statement in our readings. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude. And it goes on to say an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. It says this program is a set of principles that are written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. There's a relationship between those two statements. But my attitude is the big part of the problem. You know, it's kind of like if I'm here at this convention and I'm now here looking for the sickness, boy, I can find it in a heartbeat. And I can go home and talk about, boy, that NA convention was terrible. Did you see those people doing that? They were doing this and they were doing that. And God, you know, there's no recovery there. I might as well go use. You know, I can justify anything. But if I'm in the same situation looking for recovery, I can find that too. Sometimes people ask me about going to meetings. And, you know, I was at a meeting, oh, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there were 20, 22 people there. And the fellowship that I've just moved into, a little town, there's 7 meetings a week, and people don't have a lot of clean time. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, how do you get something when there's, you know, there isn't anybody in your local community that's been clean within 20 years of what you've been clean? And what I have to tell them is it's not those people. It's God working through those people. If I go to a meeting with an attitude that I'm not going to hear anything, that the meeting is going to be boring, then I'm not going to hear anything and the meeting is going to be boring. But if I can go to a meeting with an attitude that the God that I have chosen to commit myself to is going to give me what I need and that I'll hear what I need and I can listen, then I'll get everything I need from that meeting regardless who's there. Sometimes we use an excuse that, you know, well, there's no one here. But, you know, and some of the most profound things about recovery I've heard out of the mouths of newcomers who had no idea what they were saying in the first place. You know. Probably I hear more profound things out of newcomers than I do out of people who have painstakingly and painfully considered what they're going to say at their next meeting so they'll sound good. You know. And we've all done that, right? You know, my part of my story is memorizing the little white booklet so I wouldn't sound like a fool. You know, sometimes when I get up and talk, you know, the worst thing that can happen up here is I can get up here and I can share it for a while, and you guys can think I'm a complete fool, right? But you know, I already identified as an addict. And you know that already. So what the hell? You know, we don't get here because things are going good in our life. We don't get here because we're successful. We don't get here because we're capable of having relationships, right? We get here because we're failures. Relationships is an interesting topic. And I will talk about relationships because I think it's really important to talk about relationships. I think recovery is all about relationships. Yeah. It's all about changing our relationships with ourselves, with those around us, with reality, and with God. It's all about changing our relationships. You know, as far as, you know, taking lovers and stuff like that, we don't do that good. We are not good lovers. We don't know how to have healthy, interpersonal, partnership-type relationships. We don't do that good because addiction is the antithesis of a healthy relationship. You know, when it says, you know, your whole life and thinking is centered in drugs in one form or another, they're getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. I identify with that, but, you know, does that leave much room for another human being? Yeah, I could be, you know, close to someone else. I'm not going to say intimate with someone else, because how intimate can you be when you got, you know, you're loaded? It's kind of like, I'm so spiritual, everything's distorted. Yeah, I sought spirituality through, you know, a variety of chemicals back in the 60s, but, you know, the reality is, I think, that you know, all that stuff ever did was distort my relationship with God. It didn't enhance it. It, you know, it made it like a hallucination, and it wasn't real. Same thing was true with relationships. Every relationship I ever had was distorted by my use of drugs. You know, and you know, if I was loaded, I could tolerate you, and if I wasn't loaded, you could forget it. I wasn't there. You know, it's kind of like that second part of the disease. I do a lot of things with those three parts of the disease: physical, mental, and spiritual. You know, the mental, the tendency I have to get strung out on anything. Fall in love with people and get obsessed with them. You know, I don't have healthy relationships with people. You know, I either build them up to the point where they're going to have to disappoint me, I tear them down to the point where I won't even try, or I set myself up so that I can tell myself in the end, see, I told you no one could love me. See, I told you I was no good. See, they were right about me after all. You know, I sabotage. And spiritually, you know, I can't relate to another person who's an equal in my addiction. Today I'm beginning to learn that. And that kind of makes it the opposite of love. Addiction and love are pretty much mutually exclusive, just like obsession and love. I think obsession happens in a lot of relationships, but that's not love. You know, love and obsession are two different things. I didn't know that. I didn't know how to have a healthy relationship with anybody. Luckily, and certainly through no fault of my own, particularly early on, I'm also happily married. I have been married longer than I've been clean, and I've been monogamous longer than I've been clean. And I respect my wife, and we're good friends. I have one of those relationships that survived NA. And, you know, some of you have heard me say that before, but it's really true. This fellowship, if addiction isn't bad enough, because in my addiction I was fulfilling some of my wife's needs, being able to take care of me and stuff like that, I started getting clean and I wasn't fulfilling those needs anymore. I found out most of the reasons we got married for were not valid anymore. And I had to kind of put that relationship on hold. Since then, you know, I've learned how to love a little bit. Since then, I've learned a little bit about how to have relationship. And I believe that relationships are critical in early recovery. I hear people saying no relationships in the first year. And I say, you damn well better have some. There are five specifically that I think you should work on. And they have nothing to do with sex. The first one is called honesty. Honesty. And that's relationship with yourself. And, you know, we talk about cash register honesty. Don't lie, cheat, or steal. And we stress that early on. And that was tough because when I came around to NA, I couldn't go in a store without stealing something. I wasn't any big-time thief or anything. I was just a little petty thief, and I'd steal paperback books and sunglasses and cigarettes and candy bars and combs and Christmas presents and just general, you know, little stuff. I couldn't go anywhere without taking something. And I remember somebody told me early on, well, if you got trouble going in a store, one of the things you can try is stick your hands in your pocket. And if you go in the store, go for a reason, and when you get the thing that you want, you take one hand out of your pocket, and you grab it, and you put it in the hand, and you hold it out here where everybody can see. And you keep your other hand in your pocket. And when you get to the register, then you set the thing down and put your hand in your pocket, take the other hand out of your pocket, and give them the money, and then put your hand back in your pocket. And after they wrap it, you can take one of your hands out of your pocket again and grab the package and walk out. Now, it's tough to steal anything with your hands in your pocket. And I did that, and it worked, and over a period of time, I learned how not to go into a store with stealing something. But that's how I had to approach it. You know, it's funny, the same guy later on, I was talking about my anger and wanting to punch people out and stuff like that, and he said, put your hands in your pockets. It's really tough to punch. I was like, I guess that was his big answer. But, I mean, it worked. These simple things worked for me, and they were really neat. They were really helpful things, and I don't, you know, And people would tell me how to live, and they, you know, do things like come and get a sponsor. And, you know, that's another one of those relationships I believe in. The second relationship that I think is real critical around this program Well, actually, it's the third one that I usually say, but I'll use it as the second this time, is sponsorship. And that's to find somebody that can help you with that. Learning how to work this program, learning how to stay clean, learning what it means to be an NA member. Our traditions that we read said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. There are a ton of people that are out there that have a desire to stop using. I had a desire to stop using many times before I knew NA existed. I wasn't an NA member. I don't think just because you want to quit using, that makes you an NA member. I think there's more to it than that. For me, there was a degree of commitment. I think an NA member is someone who has a desire to stop using, an addict with a desire to stop using, who's chosen to recover in Narcotics Anonymous. And that's how I define an NA member. And it's more than just that wanting. Because I wanted a lot of things. I mean, wanting isn't... Sometimes I want to fly. You know, it don't matter how hard I flap my arms, they're not going to lift me off the ground that way. And, you know, wanting isn't enough for me. I have to do more than that. I have to make that commitment. I have to make that hooking up. And getting a sponsor is part of the way I do that. How many people here are on a sponsor search? Anybody? All right. Very good. If you're looking for just the right sponsor, any of you looking for the perfect sponsor? If the person you pick is a complete fool, they can't hardly screw up your life any worse than you already have. At least they're not prejudiced about your life. You know, one of the things that my sponsor does for me is he can see my behavior without all this crap that I've accumulated over 46 years of living getting in the way. He's impartial about me. I am incapable of being objective about Greg. I have all my desires and all my fears and all my experience and all my hopes and all this shit that gets in the way of seeing myself objectively. My sponsor can be objective. If you're looking for a sponsor and you're trying to find the perfect one, you probably won't. Everyone in Narcotics Anonymous that I have ever met has defects. And if you hang around them long enough, sooner or later those defects are going to shine on you. If you're going to pick a sponsor, you're going to want to hang around on them for a while, right? And chances are those defects are going to shine on you. And I know people who run from sponsor to sponsor to sponsor to sponsor for years and years and years and never trusted anyone. And that's a tragedy. Because there's something real special about that relationship, that sponsorship relationship. If you're looking for a sponsor, find someone who lives this way, who lives the NA way. Find someone who's worked some of these steps. Find someone who is committed. Find someone who's not living on the edge anymore. Find someone who can answer the question, how would someone act if they really believed this shit? Interesting question. One of those handy-dandy questions you can use when you're working the steps. I mean, like the first step. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. No, that's the second step. First step. But maybe we were powerless to our addiction, their lives become unmanageable. How would someone act if they really, 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 really believed that they were powerless over their addiction, their life would become unmanageable? How would someone act if they really believed they had a disease that would kill them in the most horrible of ways and take everything of value in their life in the process, and they had no power to control it? Do you think they'd be testing it with a little near beer? Do you think they'd be hanging out at the pool hall saying, I can handle it. I ain't going to touch anything that the rest of the folks are touching. You think they'd be living on the edge? And, you know, we all have, right? Most of us, when we first come around, hang on to some of those old places. But I honestly believe when I committed myself to that idea, when I surrendered to that idea, that I was powerless over my addiction and that my life had become unmanageable, I quit going to those places and I quit doing those things that were flirting with my disease. The third relationship I want to talk about is a relationship with each other. It's called fellowship. If you don't feel like you're a part of, chances are you're not. Chances are you're not doing the things that people are doing who feel like they're a part of. Narcotics Anonymous is more than an hour and a half in the evening. If you're still checking us out, check us out. Take as long as you want. There is no time frame for you to, you got to make a decision about whether or not you want to live this way, right? The longer you check us out, the longer you'll stay clean, hopefully, if you're not using it. You know, check us out for 20 years. It's kind of like working the steps. You know, some of you are probably sitting there struggling with, I don't want to work these damn steps. And this person told me I was to write this stuff, and, you know, I don't want to write it. I can't write it. My writing doesn't work, and I don't want to. Don't do it. Just stay clean. Don't do it. It's not going to hurt me. You know, we're entitled to our pain. I don't want to write an inventory. Don't write an inventory. As long as you can stand it. My experience is there came a point where I was going, please show me how to write an inventory. You know, you're struggling with making amends. Don't make amends. You don't have to do that. You don't have to make any amends. Just don't use nothing, no matter what, even if your ass falls off. And if it does, well, pick it up, put it in a brown paper bag, and bring it to a meeting. You know, what the heck? You know, you don't have to do that stuff. Just stay clean. I believe if you stay clean, you will either destroy yourself or work the steps. And, you know, you can wait as long as you want. You know, we're entitled to our misery. And I was pissed off when people tried to take away my... I got a right to feel bad! You know, yeah. I got a right to... Yeah, I got a right to feel bad. It's kind of like asking for fairness. I don't... Thank God life's not fair, huh? I'm a firm believer in this. It's a good thing we get what we get instead of what we deserve. I mean, it, really, you know... Because if I got what I deserved, I'd be dead. You know, I was not living out there a good, healthy, happy, joyous, and free life. Like, you know, I came to Narcotics Anonymous, was go to hell and turn limp. And I have been clean, and I have been a member of Narcotics Anonymous over half my life, which is a trip. It's something that I can't fathom. You know, which also means I've been married over half my life, which is even more bizarre than being clean half my life. I can figure out being, if I don't use nothing, I'll stay clean. But God, it's marriage shit. I don't know. Anyway, three relationships so far. Honesty, fellowship, sponsorship. The fourth relationship is called integrity. And it's a relationship with principles. It's called strict adherence to a moral code. And you know what? There's some rules around NA. There's some unwritten rules around NA. It's not all right to abuse each other. It's not all right to rip each other off. It's not all right to hit on each other. It's not all right to lie in here. It's not all right to hang around and keep using. We sometimes say it is. One of the things that I think is real sad, and sometimes with our newer members and our people coming back, I see us, you know, people come back from a relapse and we pat them on the back and tell them it's all right. It's okay. It's not okay. Sorry. Relapse is against everything that Narcotics Anonymous stands for. I was told in my first meeting that I never ever had to use again against my will. And I believe that. If you're coming back from a relapse, God bless you. I love you. Stick around, but it ain't okay. Don't do that shit no more. And there's a place for you, and we need you, and we want you. But stop it. It's not okay. It's not okay. I see that kind of mindset. Strict adherence to a moral code. We have a moral code. Sometimes we don't talk about that enough. But it's real, 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 real important. The fifth relationship I want to talk about briefly is spirituality. I don't know if I'll talk about it briefly. Most of what I'm going to say is probably going to be one way or another related to spirituality, because that's the big story of my recovery, is the beginnings of the development of a relationship with the God of my understanding, the beginnings of a relationship with spirituality has become, at my best, the central focus of my life, at my worst, something I'm too obsessed with something else to pay much attention to. But at my best, it is the central focus of my life, spirituality. And I like those times when I'm at my best. Anyway, those five relationships, honesty, fellowship, sponsorship, integrity, and spirituality,
are critical to early recovery. If you can work on those, if you can make some progress on those, then chances are someday you'll be able to hook up with another human being and end up with something other than a tragedy. I didn't know how till I knew about those other things. I didn't know how till I started living this way and committed myself to living by principle rather than by my desires, rather than by my great ideas. One of the things I learned early on in the program is when the light bulb goes off in my head, I got an idea! The first thing I got to do is unscrew the light bulb. Because I'm in trouble. It's kind of like I'm firing on all cylinders now, but the wiring's still messed up. Yeah, and it's not running real smooth, but, it's okay. Anyway, I mentioned briefly that I had five cars broke down last Monday, and I was not happy with my higher power. By the end of the day Tuesday, I had reached a point within myself where I was grateful. I was able to express the fact that I'm real thankful to my higher power for postponing the suicide of those five cars until I was in a situation where I could afford to take care of those problems and have them repaired. And instead of being pissed off at God for fucking up my day, I could be able to look at that same situation and be grateful to God for giving me what I need when I need it and never giving me more than I can handle. And that's growth for Greg. Because I used to get stuck in that being pissed off at God for screwing up my day. And I'd live there. And I couldn't get to that being grateful that I wasn't given more than I could handle. Or that I was given everything I needed. I got lost in all that. Let me tell you a little bit about how my program has changed lately. Before I do that, let me tell you a little bit about some of the stuff I've experienced in recovery. Because I came around Narcotics Anonymous. I haven't talked at all about my using, have I? I did that. I qualified. And the last year or so that I was doing that kicked my ass enough to find Narcotics Anonymous. And it was the feelings. 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 It was the loneliness. It was the fear. It was the frustration. It was the pain. It was the hopelessness. It was the living death that forced me to seek help. There was a series of events that happened in my last year of my using that destroyed all faith I had in myself or anything else. The woman that I've been married to for 23 plus years had a baby in December of 1969. I had my son. And we gave that child up for adoption. And that was a very, very important event for me in my last year of my using. Because it forced me to an awareness that I don't think I would have gotten to. You see, I really wanted to keep that child. And I really, really felt a sense of responsibility. And I couldn't promise to be around and to help raise that child. Because I realized that if I continued the way I was going, I probably would not live 6 months. And it was a beginning of really a change in Greg. The next thing that happened, probably about a little later than this, in 1970, was my grandmother died. She was a dope fiend too, and she took too many reds one night and slipped and fell and scalded to death in the shower. A dope fiend's death, huh? Yeah. Only a dope fiend would die that way. But I blamed myself, you see, because I couldn't stand being around her. She was one of these grandmothers that got on your nerves, and she didn't live that far away. And so I avoided her for the last year or so of her life. And when she died, there was part of me that was going, at least you won't have to put up with her anymore. And another part of me was going, God, you're a horrible person for feeling that way. What kind of person are you to be glad when your grandmother dies? There was another part of me that was real sad and was shocked and was upset about her dying. But I focused on that little part of me that said, that one time it went through my head when it said, well, I'm glad I don't have to put up with her shit. And I hated myself a little more because of that. And my using popped up a little more. After she died, there was this house full of furniture. My grandfather lived and moved in with my mom, and there was this house full of furniture. So I asked that gal, I asked Lois to marry me, you know, because we'd been together. It looked like we were going to be together. There was this house full of furniture, so what the heck, you know. That was the rationale at the time. And that was an important point, because she was going to be my last link to sanity. See, I thought about the possibility of cleaning up for her, but I didn't. but I thought about it, mind you. I thought about it, and that was an improvement. A couple of days before we were supposed to get married, my best friend hung himself. He left a note that said, "I just can't think anymore." And I identified with that, too. I used to pray for the comfort of idiocy. God, if only I didn't have to think anymore. If only I could shut this thing off. It'd be okay. And I tried hard. That's part of what I was using about, was trying to shut this thing off. Because I couldn't, I was going all the time. And I couldn't shut it off, and I couldn't slow it down. And, you know, I almost got that comfort of idiocy, except what I found out, you know, after a bunch of years of using, was that it wasn't as comfortable as I thought it was going to be. And I still had the feelings, that loneliness and desperation and all that stuff. One event that I want to share with you in a little detail is something that happened, though, probably 90 days before I cleaned up. I remember it vividly. I was sitting backwards on a toilet, like I so often did. I was sick. I couldn't get a vein. I was dripping blood on the floor. And I was going, "God damn, look what's become of me. Look at me. This is not the way it was supposed to turn out. This is ain't okay. This is not okay. Look what's become of me." And I hated myself. And I loathed the fact that that little kid who had those dreams had gotten up, ended up where he ended up. And I could not rationalize myself off that toilet and say it was okay. And I believe you have a time just like that. I don't know what the details are of it. Maybe it was going to treatment. Some stranger says, "You're going to have to come in this room and take off your clothes so we can search you." You know, maybe it was waking up in bed with a stranger. Maybe it was waking up in bed with a friend that you didn't intend to go to bed with. That might be worse. Yeah. Maybe it was giving up a child. Maybe it was having a child taken away from you. Maybe it was stealing a Social Security check from your grandparents. Maybe it was selling your friends bad dope. Maybe it was waking up in prison one more time going, "God, I was going to do so good. What happened? How'd I get back here?" Maybe it was holding somebody in your arms after you sold them an overdose and they were dying. Maybe it was hitting a kid with a car when you were loaded. Maybe it was, maybe it was, maybe it was, maybe it was, but you got one. And please don't ever forget it. As much as you want to shove that memory away, as much as you want to leave that memory in the past, please don't ever forget that time when you knew it wasn't okay to be who you were. When you knew it wasn't okay to live the way you were living. When you knew somehow things had to change. Because there are times I stayed clean just so I'd never have to feel that way again. There were times when that memory kept me clean. Please don't forget your own. And share it with someone. Share that painful time with someone and let them share theirs with you. Because we all got them. I started looking for help. I started calling the helplines, the hotlines, the high lines, whatever they are. There wasn't much to pick from in those days. Those things they said on the radio at 3 a.m. "If you got a problem, call such and such." And a suicide line. Eventually hooked up with Narcotics Anonymous. And someone said, I think it was suicide prevention, "Are you eligible for Narcotics Anonymous?" And I said, "I don't know. What do you got to be?" I said, "Well, we don't know either. We got this phone number, so why don't you call them?" And so I called, and they said, "Do you have a car?" There weren't very many cars in Narcotics Anonymous in 1970. And, you know, they wanted to see if I could take people to meetings. I don't know if that's really true or not, but I was taking people to my meetings my first week. And, yeah, I had a car. And there were perhaps 200 NA members in the world and 20 NA meetings in the world. And I was fortunate to be in Southern California in a time when Narcotics Anonymous was available, when it was possible to stay clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And I went to my first meeting on a Thursday night in Hollywood, California, on the corner of Yucca and Gower in the basement of a church. And someone said there what I shared before, you never have to use again against your will. And I went, yeah, okay. I don't remember much else of that first meeting, but that statement is somehow very, very important to me. If you can identify with that, you never have to use again against your will. You can identify with that. There's not much question of whether or not you believe it belong here, because not very many non-addicts use against their will. I think only we understand keeping doing the things we have to do to get high, to stay loaded, keeping paying the price, knowing how it's going to hurt, but just having to keep on. I think only we understand about keeping promising ourselves that this time it's going to be different. And keep it on, keep it on. So if you understand that statement, you're definitely in the right place. And it's kind of like one of my awarenesses recently has been involved in that saying we have, you know, like insanity is repeating the same mistakes and expecting different results. That's really true. That's a good definition of denial. Repeating the same mistakes and expecting different results. Denying the experience of my past. For me, one of the things I've learned is that insanity may be even more insidious than that. Is repeating the same mistakes, knowing what the results are going to be, and going on and doing it anyway. Yeah. One of the most recent examples of that was when I got ripped off for a lot of money, about 4 years ago. Lost everything. And I gave myself permission to eat one more time. Gained 100 pounds. I gained 180 pounds when I stopped using. I gained 130 pounds when I quit smoking. You know, and over a period of years, my weight's fluctuated dramatically. And the most recent example of that was, like I said, after having been ripped off, and I said, well, Greg, if worse comes to worse, you can always eat. And I knew what was going to happen. And I knew I'd, quote, hate myself in the morning, unquote. But anything for relief, huh? Anything to medicate those feelings. Part of what I want to share with you tonight is, you know, I'm standing up here with 23 years clean, and I don't have perfect recovery. There are days when it's real good. But there are days when I'm hanging on. When I need every bit of love and support and confrontation that you can give me. And when it's real good, it's real good. But when it's not real good, you don't want to be in the same state with Greg. You know, because I can tear up a state. One of the things that's common about, we can tear up a state in 24 hours. I mean, that was one of the problems I had with the 10th step. You know, continuing to take personal inventory and doing it at the end of the day, like, you know, people historically, you know, talk about it. I can create so much shit in a day, it takes me weeks to dig out from underneath it. You know, months, years. You know, and that wasn't enough for me. I'd do more than that. Anyway, back to that coming around. I came to my first meeting early in October of 1970. I was wearing a three-piece black suit, vest, tie, shoes. God, strange stuff. They came from under the box underneath my bed. I bathed. That was a big deal. I didn't bathe a lot back. It was, back in the 60s, there was this acid trip, and ever since then, water hurt, you know? But I bathed, you see, because one of the things that this was a thing called Narcotics Anonymous. God, there were going to be drug addicts there. God, drug addicts, you know, those things. And I've read about drug addicts. I knew about people like us. And I was scared to death because I was, you know, I was 23 years old. And I just used every day for 15 years. That's all. I've never been arrested. Never been hospitalized. There was no treatment to go to, so I'd never been in treatment. You know, I never did a lot, and I never was in Tascadero State Mental Hospital in California. I never did a lot of those things. All I did was get loaded. And I was the guy that was driving up and seeing the strange cars at the connections house. It sounded like I'll go somewhere else this time. I can remember one time, I walked into this bus and walked out. the 14 police that were there to bust these two friends of mine, you know, said, "Son, you're in the wrong place." And I was going, "Yes, sir." And I don't know why I didn't get busted. You know, because I was in the right place because I wanted some of their morphine. You know. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, I don't know why. Sometimes I wonder about, you know how it was when we were using, we were going, "Why me?" In recovery, I go, "Why me? Why have I been so fortunate? Why was I so fortunate to be allowed to clean up? Why didn't I die of this disease? You know, why have I stuck around? Why haven't I gone out like some of my friends have?" And I don't know, you know, the only thing I can figure out is, you know, somehow, some way, I will have an opportunity to carry a message in somewhere where I wouldn't have an opportunity to carry it if I had a prison record. And you know, I may be doing that today. I don't know that I've shared this in front of a large group before, but you know, today I work in for the state of Tennessee. I work with the Department of Youth Development. Manager in a juvenile prison. And it's bizarre. I never ever thought I'd end up working in corrections. And I kind of enjoy it. But it's weird. It's one of those, you know, God, if they only knew. Really, you know. But the other side of that coin is, so, if they only knew. I mean, the reality of my life is that I'm qualified for that job. Because I have living experience, because I have education, because I have years and years and years working in adolescent treatment, because I have experiences that qualify me to work in that job. But my head still goes, they don't know they got a dope fiend in here. They don't know what I'm thinking. You know, but it's okay. I don't have to dwell on all that crap. Anyway, I came to that meeting. I was scared to death. I was afraid he wouldn't accept me. I used twice after that. My first meeting was on a Thursday night. I used the following Sunday night behind lack of sleep. I hadn't slept in 7 days. And I knew how to sleep. I went and got some drugs and I slept. And I used the following night behind a 12-step call. Of course, I had 7 days clean, so the following Sunday night. What had happened is I came back to Narcotics Anonymous after that first time I used, and they'd embarrass you back in those days. It's kind of weird today. You can go to some obscure meeting in a small town, 75, 100 miles away from where you live, and sneak in and pick up a new white chip, and no one will know. You know how that is? Some of you have probably done that, right? And you know, it's when you get around your birthday time, like 6 months later, and you go, "Oh no, I had some problems about 6 months ago, and I've had to change my recovery date." You know, I mean, I've heard people say that a lot of times, and that's okay. But you know, back in 1970, there weren't a lot of NA members, and if you weren't in a meeting, you weren't around, and so you know, everyone knew when you went out and screwed up, and they'd embarrass you. You know, there was a guy who used to hand out matchbooks and say, "Go burn yourself out, chump." And there was a guy who used to say, you know, "Don't talk to me for a year. You violated what I believe in." You know, there are people that dim and they get down on your case. But anyway, I came back and I stood up. I used to say, "Do you have any newcomers within their first 30 days? Will you please stand up?" And I'm going, "Oh, they didn't give white chips. They just made you stand up." And everybody knew. Everybody knew, and it was embarrassing. One of the reasons that I got clean was that I was embarrassed for going out and using. Now, whether or not I should have been embarrassed or not, you know, I know about relapse as part of the disease of addiction. You know, I hear people say relapse is part of recovery. I could draw the line there. That's bullshit. Relapse has nothing to do with recovery. Relapse is about misplaced priorities. Something has become more important than staying clean. Yeah. I know that the disease of addiction is a disease that often includes relapse, but it's not recovery. It's kind of like saying, "My recovery is so painful." You know, I hear people talk about recovery being painful. Recovery is not painful. You know, when I'm sitting in the corner with my head blowing up, with my head going crazy, depressed, insane, nuts, hating life, it's not because I'm working such a good program.
Sorry. It's not because I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. It's not because I'm living spiritual principles. It's because I'm not doing that stuff. What's painful is not recovery. Lack of recovery is what hurts like hell. You know, it's kind of like that commercial. How do you spell relief? You know, recovery is relief from that pain. If I live this way, I don't hurt like hell all the time. When I quit living this way, I end up violating myself some more and hating myself. Self-violation. I end up doing things that I hate myself for doing. I end up setting myself up. You know, and that's the difference. Anyway, I went around and I did what we all do when we come around in and out of this program and in the program. And I came back. I had an attitude adjustment that second time I used. I went to one of my using buddies and I thought, I found this wonderful thing. Narcotics Anonymous. Come with me to a meeting. Because you taught me to take him to a meeting, right? First thing you do is newcomers, bring him to a meeting. Well, so I brought him to a meeting. And on the way home from the meeting, he was going, this is bullshit I'm going to go use. You know, all those people, they don't get to stay clean. And I said, you can't do that. Because if you do that, I'll have to go with you and I'll wreck my recovery. And I had 7 days. Give me a break. You know, I didn't have any recovery. I was still checking it out. You know, what I did when I came around here was I did the same thing that almost all of you did, is you look for a place to disqualify ourselves. And I looked at all the differences. The first thing that I remember hearing in a meeting after that you never have to use again against your will was I started hearing people talk about strange shit, you know, like, you know, quarter-sized holes drilled in their heads after the shock treatments. And I go, whoa, I didn't do that. You know, or 15 years in Folsom Prison. I'm going, oh, I don't want to sit next to him. And, you know, I steadily disqualified myself. I just moved from the front of the room all the way to the back of the back of the room going, oh, my God, what have I got myself into? You know, Narcotics Anonymous. Oh, no, you know. And, you know, I did that. But, you know, after I used, I had one of these attitude adjustments, you know. And it was kind of like I moved from the back of the room, checking us out, looking for the difference, to the front of the room, saying, that's my chair, and I'll fight you for it. And I don't care if I qualify perfectly for Narcotics Anonymous, and I don't care if you accept me. I don't have a lot of choices left. That's my chair. And I claimed it. And I believe if you want to be an NA member, maybe that's when membership starts, when you claim your place in Narcotics Anonymous and assert your right to stay clean and be an NA member. Maybe that's when membership starts in Narcotics Anonymous. And at 30 days, it was great. I had a wonderful pink cloud when I came around here. It was wonderful, 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 wonderful. No one was looking out after me. I wasn't in trouble anymore. People were patting me on the back. It was great. It's like a new drug, you know. Remember when you used to trade drugs and they'd work for a little while? Oh, this is great. I'll do this till it don't work no more. That's kind of like what it was like. Because not using and not waking up sick and not having to do the things I had to do to please the connection and not having to do the things I had to do to keep money going, flowing through. You know, only a dope fiend knows about having $100 in your pocket and not being able to afford a pack of cigarettes. Right. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. But at 30 days, it was wonderful, and I felt good. And at 90 days, I had all the answers. I'd memorize that little white book, and I'd say this wonderful shit, you know, like, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallels. And around Christmas or January of 1971, what that was a line that I mimicked, and I had no idea what it meant. And I quoted out of, you know, I had answered all the questions. Ask me any question, and I'd have all the little white book to memorize, you know. And, you know, honesty, open mind, innocent willingness. Indispensable. Says so. And, you know, I had no more idea about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness with 90 days than the man in the moon. You know, but I talked good. You know, it was great. I mean, I had all the answers. And the funny part about it was that, you know, I did have all the answers. There aren't a whole lot of them. They're all in that little white booklet. You know, they're really all not a whole lot more than, you know, 12 steps and 12 traditions. Chances are, if you can handle those, you can make it okay. That's about all the answers any of us really need. But anyway, shortly after that 90 days, you know, whatever you want to call it, something happened that shook me to the bone, as it was kind of like the big blue bird of humans flew over and took a dump on me. I go, oh, I don't remember why I used. You know, it was kind of like, people talk about the lifting of a veil. And sorry, I don't know. I don't identify with the lifting of a veil. It's like a bird shit on me. I go, oh, God, here it comes, you know. And you know, I started to feel all this stuff, and you know, I did not like feeling all this stuff. And that, you know, I realized that had a lot to do with why I used. And you know, at 6 months, I was going, "Oh my God, it's not the drugs," because I've been clean 6 months, and you know, I figured once I was clean, everything was going to get okay. And here I was, 6 months clean, and I hurt like hell, and I didn't have any recovery, and I didn't know what to do, and you know, it was terrible. And you know, someone suggested you might try working the program. You know, I said, "I've done that." Right? Yeah. Then they suggested you might try working the program. And I said, but you don't understand. And they said, Mike, you might want to try working the program. And they said, you have a sponsor. And I said, yeah, I have a sponsor. I asked this person to be my sponsor. Do you call them? No. I don't call them. What do you mean call them? Do you talk to them? Well, I see them at the meeting once a week. But do you talk to them? Do you ask them about recovery? Well, what is there to ask about recovery? You come to these meetings and you don't use anything and everything's wonderful. And they said, wrong. And I'm going, you're kidding. But anyway, and I went through what we all do, just before a year when you're going, fine, if I stay clean another week or two, I'll have made it. What can I do to sabotage this? How can I be a newcomer again? Or right after a year when you're going, boy, I'm glad that's over with, and I can get back like living around like a real person. You know, yeah, I don't have to go to those damn meetings anymore. No, after all, I mean, it doesn't make sense, does it? You go sit in these rooms an hour and a half in the evening, and, you know, your life, it's crazy. People don't talk much stuff in those, you know, what is this about? How does, it doesn't work. Can't work. It doesn't make sense. You know, it's funny. We expect recovery to make sense. You know, addiction is not a rational process. Why should recovery be so rational and concise and make sense? I mean, my whole life doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that I'm alive. It doesn't make sense that I'm standing up here. What makes sense is divine inspiration. What makes sense is divine intervention. What makes sense is divine grace. And none of those things can be quantified or counted or lined up or put in nice square little holes. Like, and it's kind of like my idea of balance. I used to think balance was like a picture, and the program teaches us to seek balance. And, you know, my idea of balance was a place for everything and everything in its place. One of the recent realizations I've had is I started thinking about balance, and I thought about the guy up on the high wire, and is he standing perfectly still? No, he's moving all the time. Or a broom on your hand. You can't balance the broom if you don't move your hand. And what I realized is balance is continual adjustment to life. It's not static. It's not like a picture. It's not a place for everything and everything in its place and nothing changes. That's boring. You know, that's death. What balance is a continual adjustment based on principle. It's what happens when you work the 10th step. You continue to take personal inventory, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. You adjust. And when you do something wrong, you take care of it. You know, if you start heading off in the wrong directions, you change directions. You know, if you don't like the way your life is going, change the way you live. It's the principle of reciprocity. Something that I believe really, 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 really strongly in. You know, the way you live determines the way you live. If you don't like the way your life is going, change the way you live. You know, it's kind of, it's one of those principles that gets around a lot. People talk about, you know, you reap what you sow. Karma. People who live in glass houses should not throw stones. What goes around comes around. Do unto others as you would have. And it's all reciprocity. It's all this idea of the way you live determines the way you live. How are you living, folks? Are you living a life that's going to yield recovery? Or are you living a life that speaks more of active addiction than it does of recovery? If your answer to that question is the way you live is more like a dope fiend than a recovering addict, then chances are you're going to do eventually what a dope fiend does. And the most significant thing a dope fiend usually does is use drugs. But if you're living a life
the way a recovering addict lives, chances are you're going to be doing what recovering addicts do. And that's learn how to be happy, joyous, and free. Living life abundantly. Following a spiritual path. You know, staying away from that edge. You know, it's kind of like the only way to find out when the edge is, where the edge is when you put your foot out over nothing. I remember somebody telling me that. And yeah, I identify. I can't figure out where the edge is, so I need to back off the edge a little bit. My life was spent on that razor edge. And part of living clean has been not being out there on that razor edge. I don't have to risk my life for my feelings anymore. I don't have to risk my life for my insanity anymore. I don't have to risk my life for my disease anymore. Now, yeah, I might risk my life, but it's not for those things. Recovery has been a real trip. At 18 months, I go through what some of you are probably going through now. This is so boring. And I've been to all these meetings, and they always say the same damn thing. Well, I've heard that person share 14 times, and they still don't know shit. This is boring. And you know what? In addition to that, no one's having fun anymore around it. They're not going out to coffee after the meetings, and no one's going, God, you know, when I came around, just think of the good old days 18 months ago when I came around. People used to really enjoy themselves. They used to go, God, you know, somebody took me down by the river and we had a ball, and people aren't doing that anymore. Well, you know, people are doing all that stuff. What's happening is you're not doing that stuff. And, you know, what happened to me when I stopped doing that stuff and recovery got boring was I started having some other things happening in my life and things got more important, like, you know, Star Trek or MTV got more important than going to a meeting. And, you know, reading and all those other things, substitution had kicked in big time, and, you know, it's all right to sit up all night and read a book, but when you, you know, do that two and three and four nights in a row and you're falling asleep behind the wheel of your car going, oh my God. Well, when you're falling asleep coming home from an NA meeting and the police pull you over and they say, pick up your keys and touch your nose and all that stuff, and you're going, no, this is not what you're spending. You know, have you been drinking? No, no, I'm a recovering addict. You know, that sort of stuff, you know, and you're embarrassed, you know. Or when you go give a blood test and you want to wear long sleeves, right? You know, it's all that same sort of stuff. But I went through that stuff at 18 months, and I found out I had to recommit and re-involve myself on a different level. At 2.5 years, I went through something I see a lot of people going through. When those feelings hit and I realized that it wasn't drugs at 6 months, what I started doing, like I said, was substituting a lot. And at about 2.5, 3 years, substitution quit working. The job would no longer fix me. The hobby would no longer fix me the same way. The running from service committee to service committee to service committee would no longer fix me the same way. The new car would not fix me. The relationship would not fix me. The possessions would not fix me. The color TV was getting boring. I had seen all that stuff. A lot of the things I did early in my recovery to medicate and avoid my feelings when I didn't have much of a program quit working about 2.5 and 3 years. And I'm going, oh my God, I knew I was sick, but I had no idea. And the answer to that was, again, to recommit and reinvolve myself and get back to the basics in my program. And at 5 years, I went through something I see a lot of us going through. It seemed like the program quit working. I tried doing all the things that I was taught in NA, and I wasn't getting relief. And what I came to was the realization that I could not fix myself, even with Narcotics Anonymous. See, the way I approached this thing my first 5 years was, I have found a way to fix myself. I'll go to these meetings, I'll work these steps, I'll do the things I'm taught, and that's going to fix Greg. I didn't have any idea that that's not what the program teaches. The program says, you know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. The program says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. The program says we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. It doesn't talk about us fixing ourselves, even with NA or anything else. You know, which includes fancy, you know, methods for self-awareness, which includes ongoing whatever it happens to be. You know,
The program teaches me that I cannot fix myself, that only a loving God can fix myself. And I found myself at 4.5 years clean going, this God shit everybody's talking about, I've got to be for real or I'm fucked. Because I've run out of good ideas. And that journey is continuing today. Some of my biggest growth in the last 2 or 3 years has been involved with my relationship with my higher power. My understanding of the second step has turned itself on ear. Because I went down the path I see most of us going with on the second step. It's kind of like I started out, and the first thing I did with the second step when I was first exposed to that was I rubber stamped it. Got that, what's next? And I didn't really seriously consider this idea of coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It was, of course, I understand that. Let's go on. Let's go. I want to move quickly through this. I want to get well. You know, I was in a hurry. You know, if it takes you the rest of your life to work these steps, then you'll stay clean the rest of your life. If you're working these steps and not using them. It's not a race. You don't have to do it the first 30 days. In fact, you're not going to be able to do it the first 30 days. I'm amazed. There are treatment programs that want people to work all 12 steps the first 90 days. And I'm going, how do they do that? When I look back, it took me 5 years to have any understanding of the first step. You know, it took me 5 years to have any in-depth understanding of what it meant to be powerless over my addiction and that my life had become unmanageable. And I still am learning about that. Anyway, I went through the course that we go through on the second step. After I rubber stamped it, I came back and I said, okay, I'll seriously consider it now. And then come to believe that power greater than ourselves. Power greater. That must be this higher power stuff that everybody talks about, right? Okay. You know, it doesn't mention higher power anywhere in the steps or traditions. Interesting. But we use those terms so often. Came to believe that this higher power can restore me. Higher power. That must be this God stuff they talk about in the third. You know, they talk about God of understanding. So, I come to believe that God can restore me to sanity. And after all, the craziest thing I ever did was use drugs. So, my second step became, I believe that God can fix my addiction. I mean, that's what it boiled down to. And I don't believe that that's untrue. I believe that that's probably true. But I don't think that's what the second step says. Today, my understanding of the second step is something entirely different. I believe very strongly in divine intervention. And I believe that God can fix addiction. But that's not the second step. Second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And what's the sanity thing? You know, I started thinking about that, and, you know, the repeating the same mistakes, expecting different results, or expecting the same result, whatever you, you know, whichever, that doesn't really fit for me, is that restoration. But what is the sanity thing? And, you know, all I can really come up with is a person who is sane is a person who is in touch and living in harmony with reality. A person who is insane is someone who's out of touch with reality, who's living life like fingernails on a blackboard, who's living life like swimming upstream. Like I used to live it. My life was like fingernails on a blackboard. You know, that grating on your spine is the way it felt to live. That's insane. That's insanity. For me today, insanity is living in harmony with reality. It's living like swimming downstream. It's this wearing life like a loose garment that I know somebody said sometime. You know, it's this living in conjunction with spiritual principles rather than in violation of spiritual principles. And what's reality? Ultimately, reality is God. So sanity has to do with getting in touch with God. But then what's the second step? We come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can get us back in touch with reality and with God. Well, what's this power greater than ourselves? If the power greater than ourselves isn't God, then what is it? And what I've come to believe, and for me today, my second step is that I come to believe that this process can restore my spirituality. I come to believe that by living the NA way, that I can be restored to a healthy, proper relationship with God and with reality. That this is all about a restoration of spirituality. And that's changed all the rest of the steps for me. That changes the fourth step. Well, it changes my third step, first of all, to be and live in life. I got to be honest, insecure in the knowledge that there's a loving God that will care for me. That this process, that if I can trust the process, if I can trust this God as I understand it, and I can commit myself and stay out of the way and keep my shit out of the way, then things are going to turn out okay. Then I'm going to get what I need and never get any more than I can handle, like you told me when I first came around. And so far, so good. You know, maybe it's impossible for an addict to stay clean forever. Maybe this whole thing is a scam. But you know, it's been a good 23 years. And my life today is a whole lot better than it's ever been before. Even with the cars breaking down and the being ripped off and all this crap that goes on to distract me from this process of getting more in touch with God. So my third step today is living life insecure in the knowledge that God will care for me, that care for my will and my life. And my fourth step, instead of becoming like my first four steps were show and tell, an exploration of the unmanageability of my life, it becomes more in line with what it says, an assessment of my morality, my sense of right and wrong, my rules for living, what I believe, my morals, and an assessment of those things which have prevented me from growing spiritually. And my fifth step becomes a further exploration of that. And six and seven, instead of being, you know, coming to terms with my failures, it's looking at and coming to terms with what has prevented me from growing spiritually and humbly asking God to remove those barriers to spiritual growth, to eliminate the things that stand between me and union with the God I believe in. And I believe that Narcotics Anonymous is just as sure a path to enlightenment as any religion. You know, however you want to call that. I believe that Narcotics Anonymous is just as sure a path to enlightenment as any religion. And it doesn't contradict any other path. That's maybe one of the unique things. It embraces all other paths. And it's changed my eighth and ninth step. And you know, it's funny. If my defects are those things that separate me from God, if my shortcomings, when I'm humbly asking Him to remove my shortcomings, I'm asking for the removal of those things that prevent spiritual growth, God answers real easily. He says, no sweat, I got you covered. Here's what I'm going to do. We're going to take care of all that shit in your past that is keeping you from growing spiritually. You're going to do some amends. You're going to make a list and you're going to make some amends. You're going to restore your faith in yourself. You're going to restore your ability to follow a spiritual path. You're going to get rid of that baggage you're carrying around. One of the key things I've learned about the eighth step is it has nothing to do with the other person. It is irrelevant how they accept it. It's about me forgiving me. It's about me letting go of the things that prevent me from growing spiritually. It's not about whether another person accepts my apology or likes me again. That doesn't matter. What matters is me. This is a self-help program. It's about helping me. It's not about helping them. And if I can look at again at those things as I'm changing the way I relate to my spirit, I'm changing the way I relate to my higher power, I'm changing the way I relate to God, it takes it out of that realm of, oh, I don't want to do this. Because I didn't want to do an amends. It was embarrassing. You know, because I was going to have you forgive me for my doing something wrong, but that's not what it's about. It's about me forgiving me for violating my morals. It's about me forgiving me. And, you know, God goes on to say, not only are we going to take care of all this shit from your past, we're going to take care of the stuff from your present. It's called a 10th step. We're going to keep you checking yourself out. And when stuff starts coming up, it gets in the way of our relationship. You're going to take care of it by promptly admitting when you're wrong. We continue to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. And you're going to maintain that balance. And you're going to adjust to life based on spiritual principles rather than being that rigid, break-in-the-wind type of thing. You're going to bend with the wind and respond to what life gives you instead of reacting and overreacting. And through the 11th step, you know, you're going to praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power of that power to carry that out. You're going to follow a path which doesn't put you in conflict with the spiritual growth. By following a spiritual path, by following knowledge of God's will, spiritual direction, and spiritual power, I'm not going to be at odds with my higher power. And those three things, I believe in the course of the steps, there are three petitions we make to God. The first one involves for me the third step, and it's asking God to care for me. It's asking God to do what I cannot do for myself, because my first step tells me I can't take care of me. I can't manage my life. In my third step, I make a decision and a commitment and a petition to God to take care of me, to do for me what I cannot do for myself. And in the seventh step, I humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings. I'm asking for change and healing and the removal of the barriers to spiritual growth. And in my 11th step, I'm asking for knowledge and power. Spiritual knowledge and spiritual power. Direction, spiritual direction. No. And I'm seeking through prayer and meditation. And I've come to believe that life's all about prayer and meditation. That life is prayer and meditation. And that terrified me when I first thought about that. What if everything you did was a form of prayer? What's your prayer, and who are you praying to? That's a frightening question. At least it was to me. Because when that question occurred to me, the way I was living was not a prayer for recovery. It was a prayer for self-will. It was a prayer for sickness. It was a prayer for my desires, my wants. It wasn't a prayer for spirituality. And I believe something that a man who was my sponsor for many, many, many years, he gave me a quote out of a book, and I didn't understand it at the time, but I remembered it. I wrote it down. And it said, the greatest prayer someone can offer to a God of any kind is the way they live. And I believe the way we live is a form of prayer. I believe what I do in the hours that I'm awake is much more important than what I say before I go to sleep or when I get up. I believe, I'm going to say it again, I believe that what I do in the course of a day is much, much more important than what I say before I go to sleep or when I get up. You know, because I say some long shit. But it's the way I live. The way I live determines the way I live. That reciprocity. Funny how these things all tie together. You know, the longer I stay clean, the less I'm able to differentiate between different things in the program. They're all interrelated and intertwined, and you know, it's bizarre. So my 11th step becomes a process of living, first and foremost. Living life as a prayer. And meditation. The most powerful, simplest form of meditation I've ever found was learning how to listen in a meeting. I talked about attitude. If I go into a meeting listening for God's will expressed through another human being, I will always hear it. If I go into a meeting listening for sickness, I'll listen for sickness. Again, what is my point of meditation? If I'm listening for God's will, my point of meditation is God's will. If I'm listening for sickness, my point of meditation is sickness. And I believe that if I can be aware of God in all things, then my consciousness becomes meditation. I'm working on those things. Prayer and meditation, I am an infant. In prayer and meditation, I am an infant. But I get some kind of feel for where I'd like to be when I grow up. You know, I'd like to be closer to God. I'd like to live life as if it were a prayer. I would like to practice the principle of devotion in all things. I would like to have my conscious awareness be first and foremost an awareness of God in all things and all people. I would like the barriers to go between me and everyone else, and between me and reality, and between me and God. I don't think those things are all that separate. And that's a description of what I want to be when I grow up, that 11th step. And in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, you know, somehow that echoes that new sense about the second step where I come to believe that this process can restore my spirituality. Having had a spiritual awakening, having gone through this process, and having been or had some restoration to my relationship with
God, to spirituality, having had a spiritual awakening. We tried to carry this message to addicts. And again, that's living. You know, I can stand up here and talk along the ship. But it's more important for you to see how I live. It's more important for me to let you know how I struggle with having 5 cars broke down. It's more important for you to see how I struggle with being unemployed for 14 months. It's more important for you to see how I struggle with coping with being ripped off for $100,000, all of which have happened since I've been clean 20 years. It's more important for you to see how I struggle with stopping smoking. It's more important for that you can see how I struggle with not medicating myself with food. It's more important that you see that recovery works in my life than anything I say. This talk's cheap. And practice these principles in all our affairs. Live by principle. And the payoff? Sounds like a lot of work, right? The payoff? Something that I've talked about for a long time. And it's something that's become, I don't understand it. It is beyond my comprehension, beyond my wildest dreams. But you know what? It's okay to be grateful. And my life means something. Wow. It's okay to be me. It's okay to be 46 years old and gray and fat and false teeth. It's okay to have cars broke down at home and not know if I'm going to be able to fix them. It's okay because I know Greg today. And I don't hate Greg today. And I don't expect Greg to be perfect today. And I know that Greg is on a spiritual journey. He's never going to arrive at it. It's okay. And in the course of living, my life counts. You have given me the opportunity to share with you. In the hall, in a car, in a room, one of the condos, up the registration desk, in merchandising, up in the hospitality room, wherever it happened to be. And you contributed to my life. And I contributed to your life. Do you realize that throughout history people have given up their lives just so it meant something? And we're given it on a silver platter. Just live this way. And your life gets to count. We touch each other's lives. We make a difference in each other's lives. How many times have you heard someone share something in a meeting that made a difference in your life? They didn't even know it. How many times has someone walked up to you and said, God, I really identified with what you shared. I mean, for most of us, those are fairly common experiences. And what it means is our lives count. It made a difference that Greg lived today. It made a difference that you lived today because you touched the people around you. Did you go up and hug anybody here today? Did you go up and say hi to anybody today? Did you be going, wow, I remember you from 4 years ago. How you doing? You don't think that's important? It's so important. It's so important. That's what this is about. It's about the pool party and the dance, although that's fun. I guess that's part of it. This is about touching each other's soul. This is about getting together with each other's spirit. This is about our lives meaning something. This is about coming back a year later and seeing, hey, wow, I remember you. You stood up and got a book. Maybe this does work. Wow, exciting. Recovery is not boring. Narcotics Anonymous is not a dead program. It's a living, vital thing. And it's our attitude.
It's our attitude.
Yeah. If you want what we have to offer and you're willing to make the effort to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. If you want to be an NA member, if you want to live this way, come get it. Go for it. Bet your ass on it. And go for it with all your work. And you'll be given gifts that no one can describe. And most of all, you'll be given back yourself. And you'll be given back a God. Thank you.